You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. I'm Emily Means. I'm filling in for Leslie Thatcher this morning. Park City purchased the 1,300-acre Bonanza Flat property in 2017, and after 2 years, Wasatch County has approved a development agreement with Park City to build trailhead parking areas. But the terms and rules for the trails have some trail users kind of riled up. So joining us to explain is Utah Open Lands Executive Director Wendy Fisher. Wendy, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you, Emily. Good to be here.
First, can we kind of clarify the status of Bonanza Flat? Have we finalized the conservation easement?
So at this point, we have not finalized the conservation easement. For Bonanza Flat, unlike some other properties, we're actually have a natural lands inventory, a management plan, and then of course the conservation easement, which includes the baseline documentation. And Utah Open Lands and Park City have spent 11 months with a steering committee that includes stakeholders ranging from some of the nonprofits that were involved in the fundraising campaign to some of the jurisdictional folks, Wasatch County, Salt Lake County, others who were involved in fundraising for this particular property as well. So we've really worked hard to get a lot of input. We've also had a number of different public surveys, and those public surveys really have given us a lot of information as well in terms of how people enjoy Bonanza Flat. But I'd like to say that I think that the bottom line for what we're really trying to accomplish, Park City and Utah Open Lands, is to really manage that property in a way that we don't love it to death. I think the one thing that people recognize about Bonanza Flat is it is an amazing property. There are wetlands, for example, on that property that are really in pristine condition. But with that, there are also places that have seen, well, I would say almost a little bit of abuse. And that's just because there hasn't been a great trail system there. Again, it was private property. It was slated for development. That's why we all rallied together to preserve that land. But now what we're doing is we are really trying to manage the recreational uses, the wildlife habitat, the watershed values of that property in a manner that is really going to be, I think, for most people, just absolutely stunning and breathtaking. When you look at just the improvements that have been done, and I know Charlie was on the radio a little bit earlier talking about the Bloods Lake Trail, that in and of itself is really, I think, one of the best examples of how this property is going to be managed in a manner that really will be beneficial to the recreational user. That Bloods Lake Trail, which Park City, Utah Open Lands, and of course Mountain Trails Foundation spent a lot of time thinking about and planning, is really a much, much, much better trail than the Bloods Lake Trail that we had before. One thing for people to understand, and I actually appreciate the rainstorm that occurred the other night. Of course, many people probably know that Little Cottonwood Canyon was closed because there was a mudslide there. We're going to see more of those sorts of weather events as we deal with climate change. And so if you can imagine areas like the Bloods Lake Trail, what it used to be, where it was just basically a barren hillside, those have the potential to really wreak havoc on Bloods Lake and the headwaters value of that particular property. So we're trying to do our best to manage into the future and ensure that we don't have those sorts of issues come about.
So one issue that people seem to be kind of concerned about, maybe not necessarily an issue or you wouldn't consider it as such, is that bringing your dog up there is kind of limited. So maybe you can kind of explain that decision, that use decision.
Sure. So first of all, I want to say that I have a dog and I love dogs. I am not a dog hater. I think dogs are awesome. What we are looking at is that Bloods Lake is actually a direct drinking water source. We've had people fairly upset and angry question whether it is a direct drinking water source, and it is. Additionally, we are not suggesting that we're going to impose watershed restrictions like they have on the Wasatch Front. But rather, what we'd like people to recognize is that this is the headwaters for the Provo River drainage, and the Provo River, through the Central Utah Water Project, actually provides 50% of the drinking water for the Wasatch Front. because it goes through all sorts of wetlands and then down through the Provo River. We're, again, not suggesting that we have a watershed-like ordinance. But, yes, we're trying to protect some of those sensitive areas. And Bloods Lake is one that we've been now monitoring for 2 years. My career has really hit an all-time high geotagging dog poop.
What does that entail exactly?
Well, you take pictures and you geo-reference piles of dog poop.
And match it to
And you match it to
breeds.
A map. No, we can't do that. Oh. I'm not doing DNA testing. We're not going to get that into it. But it's one of those things where, as you can imagine, especially if you're higher up on the property, any dog poop that's not picked up, well, that flows right down into the property itself. And so we're also monitoring the lake. We do water quality tests. And we're actually seeing through our independent tests an increase in the growth of algae. Now, this is not eutrophication. Some people think that it is. We have not detected any increased phosphate levels in the lake, so we know that's not what's taking place. And really what we're trying to do is to say 2/3 of the property is going to be open to dogs. But right now the recommendation that has come from numerous stakeholders and from all of the evidence that we have gathered is that it is probably not appropriate for dogs. Now, that is just a recommendation. That is something that I think a lot of discussion is already going to be had. And I would be the first person to say that we really appreciate public input, but some of the threatening public input, probably let's not do that. We really are just trying to make some of the best management decisions and recommendations. And first and foremost, I would put a plea out to people. Don't leave the dog bags on the trail, even if you intend to come back and pick them up. And certainly picking up poop is really going to make a huge difference because, you know, on one particular day, on a weekday, we geotagged 26 piles of poop.
Is this something that people should they have a comment, should they bring it up with the city or with Utah Open Lands?
They're welcome to bring it up with either at some point as we move forward with our recommendations. And there's a lot of complexity to this property as we've moved forward. As you just mentioned, we just barely got the development agreement Park City did through Wasatch County. So that's been a huge opportunity now that we have. So when the conservation easement moves forward for the city council to review, that of course will be an open public hearing, and we encourage people to be there. But yeah, we'd love to have all sorts of public input on this. We are trying to do our best. We have been, we're testing the algae right now to see exactly what it is. So we are trying to get the best information out there, again, so that we can ensure that this property is not something that we love to death. And again, I want to say there are a lot of trails out there that are going to be for dog use. There's a lot of property, and I just think people are going to be amazed when they see the level of recreational value that comes out of this property.
Let's move to a different area of open space in Wasatch County. We had Midway Mayor Celeste Johnson on last week, and she mentioned that the Midway Open Space Committee is actively engaging landowners in conversations about preserving their land after residents voted to fund a $5 million open space bond last year. And it seems like there is a lot of interest by landowners. So why do you think that is?
Well, Wasatch County is one of those places that I've been going there for about 23 years talking about the fact that it's important to preserve some of the agricultural heritage that's there that is really the fundamental open space in that area. And there are a lot of landowners who have always been receptive to this idea. But as is the case with a lot of landowners, their land is their cash. Their land is their inheritance. Their land is what they have to pass on to the next generation. And as much as they may want to preserve it, they may not be able to fully donate a conservation easement and take advantage of the tax incentives. So what we now have with Midway passing a $5 million bond and Wasatch County passing a $10 million bond is there's $15 million to leverage in that area for open space preservation. We actually have several landowners that we are talking to who are interested in preserving their land. And so we've actually been actively working with those landowners, moving through the process. Some of the landowners are on the Midway City, Wasatch County boundaries. And I think what you see in Wasatch County is the same thing that you see in Park City. And it's what we saw when Utahban Land started here in 1990. And that is, we really have a lot of our economy tied to the out of doors, the recreation, the scenic values. And it really is an economic driver to preserve some of these open spaces. And Wasatch County really hasn't been able to do that. So when you drop over I-40 and you look at that wide open space, those are what typically people call the North Fields. Well, those are not protected. And so there's a big move now with a lot of landowners to say, yeah, we want to see this agricultural heritage protected. And of course, with a vote of the people, that's what they're trying to do. So we actually have a couple of landowners we're hoping to announce soon that we are working on a couple of those preservation projects. We've gotten some appraisals done, and we're working on the terms of conservation easements for several landowners over there.
So other conservation projects that you've worked on have been a lot of money, and we're working with $15 million here, you just said. What can we get for $15 million?
Well, the price of land is pretty high. So when you start looking at those values similar to what we see in Park City, yeah, that land costs a lot. So what we're asking for, which is typical, and it's similar to people who are very familiar with the Armstrong Snow Ranch pastures, right? That was a $16 million conservation easement that through the good graces and the generosity of the Armstrong families, we were able to get that conservation easement through a lot of fundraising for $6 million. We're trying to implement the same sort of thing so that $15 million through tax incentives, through federal funding like the NRCS, through funding from the state fund, the Leroy McAllister Fund, which call your legislator and tell them you like open space, because that's the only way we get these things done. We're hoping to leverage that $15 million, maybe be able to double that so that what comes into the community for open space preservation is $30 million. Still, you know, that land is expensive. And so we are really relying on the landowners who are willing to hopefully donate a portion of the value as well.
You just mentioned Armstrong Snow Ranch Pastures, which was kind of a really tight deadline for you just last month, I think. Is there any final thoughts that you wanted to mention on that?
I just think that time and time again, it is amazing to see how this community rallies together, and not just for open space, but really for community values. And I think everybody realizes that that's what keeps Park City, Park City. And the open space is definitely a part of that. But with the Armstrong Snow Ranch pastures, beyond the amazing contribution that both sides of the Armstrong families made, I think that it was amazing to us to see in a short time frame the people come together and raise $2.5 million. Of course, the city, $3.5 million, rough numbers, that's been put into that. And It's an amazing piece of property, and I think, again, it's one of those things that we'll look back 10 years from now, like we do with all of our open spaces, and say, yeah, glad that didn't turn out to be a high-density development.
Wendy, there's one more thing I wanted to talk about with you, and that is the general state of open space across the state of Utah. And a recent report from the Center for American Progress and Conservation Science Partners shows that the United States has lost a lot of land to development between 2001 and 2017. And in Utah, it's nearly 580,000 acres of land. So what did you think when you saw that number? Were you surprised?
Not so much surprised, because living and breathing it every day, you see the turnover of land. But I think one of the things that I look at is we've got an outdoor industry here in the state of Utah that is about $12.3 billion. That is huge. That's a clean industry, and that obviously is an economic driver. And I can guarantee you that people are not coming here for development. When you look at that number, what they're coming here for is the recreational access and opportunity, and then also the scenic values. Scenic value and recreational opportunity are the top two reasons that people move to relocate their businesses here. So again, I keep trying to point to the economic values, because sometimes in a conservative state like Utah, there isn't necessarily an immediate reaction of, yeah, we should be protecting that open space. But the other thing that I think we also look at is disproportionately the land that's being gobbled up is some of our farmland. And when you think about climate change, when you think about your carbon footprint, there was a study that was done that said that if refrigerated trucks dead-ended here in the state of Utah, in other words, we had no produce to send into those refrigerated trucks, that our food values, our food costs would go up by 30%. Well, they're not making any more land. And so, as many farmers have said, once it's developed, that is the last crop. And I think what we need to look at is, what are some of those losses of land? And is there a better way to grow and do smarter development and really protect those prime agricultural fields, but also protect those places that we love to play? And I think that's what Utah Open Lands has always done for almost 30 years now. And so it's a race against time, and it's not going to stop. So that's what we're looking at. And certainly the most recent report demonstrates that our work is not over. I think the last thing I would say about it, and it comes back to Bonanza Flat as well, is that because we're not making any more land, and because more land is being developed, we really have to look at how we are good stewards. And that's going to take everybody. How do you treat the landscape? Do you practice leave no trace principles? How do you engage with the environment? Because what you do today on the trail and how you interact both with nature and with your fellow trail users is only going to become more of a thing, so to speak, because we are going to get out there more and we're going to have less land to do it. If we're good stewards, that's going to go a huge long way. And that's really what we're asking for.
All right, Wendy Fisher from Utah Open Lands, thanks so much for joining us this morning. It's 8:35. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. I'm Emily Means, filling in for Leslie Thatcher. Park City Municipal is slowly plugging away at its goal of bringing 800 affordable or attainable housing units online by 2026, with 54 completed at last count. Joining us with an update on the city's affordable housing projects is Park City Housing Manager Jason Glidden. Good morning, Jason.
Good morning, Emily.
How are you? It's 54, right, that we've finished?
I haven't done the math recently, but I'm sure you're pretty close.
That's about right, I think. Well, speaking of units that are coming online, I was walking down Park Avenue by the library a couple days ago, and I saw what I think are the new Woodside Park Phase 1 units looking freshly painted. Are those units ready to be occupied?
Not yet. You know, as with any construction project, it's that last 10% that takes the longest, and it's the final touches. So we're still going through some punch list items for some of the units there, and there's some paperwork that has to be completed. You know, we did get approval on the plat, but actually after you get that approval from City Council, it needs to go through the process of review to make sure that legally all the wording is correct and everything like that. So that takes a little bit of time. So we're in the revisions of finalizing that plat. That needs to happen prior to any sale of those units. So in addition to that, we are working right now for a PERS certification from Fannie Mae. And what that does is certifies the project through Fannie Mae, which makes it easier for folks to go and get financing through some of Fannie Mae's products. And so we've submitted our application for that. We're waiting to hear back. So those are the two pieces of paperwork really that we really need to get completed prior to us going ahead and looking to find buyers for those.
These are 8 units or 7 units plus one?
There's a 7 units plus one. The City Council has decided to retain the one unit right now. And, you know, they'll allow them some time to discuss that a little bit more. You know, we're looking at it as a possible recruitment tool for us as a city. But there is also the opportunity to, in the future, if we decide to, that we want to go ahead and sell that, we could as well.
The City Council directed staff a month or so ago to pursue a weighted selection process for Woodside Phase 1. When can people put their name in the hat, and what do they need to know about this process?
Well, we've been gathering all the stuff, the paperwork for that selection process and the applications and putting that together. Again, we really didn't want to go ahead and release that information until we know that we have all our paperwork done and that we've gotten through the majority of the punch list items to make sure that the project is actually, or the units are ready to go. So we're waiting on those. We're hopeful that we're, you know, September, that you'll start to get the word out about the selection process. And like you said, the city council decided to go to a weighted system, selection process rather, and where you're going to, in a sense, you can get more chances in the lottery if you are able to meet certain criteria, such as if you're an essential worker, such as a policeman or fireman, or if you are a community builder, and we've defined that as, you know, the teachers, non-emergency staff at hospitals, those type of folks, government employees. And then, you know, other things like, do you work in city limits? You can get an extra chance, in a sense, if you work within the city limits here. Or if you've been working or living here, employed within the school district boundaries for 5 or more years. So those are the type of things that, you know, we really want to, in a sense, give some extra chances for those folks who have actually been part of the community for a little bit longer.
The city council directed staff, I'm just looking at my list of questions here, but let's look to Woodside Park Phase 2, which was sent back to the Planning Commission by the Board of Adjustment based on what they viewed as not a very solid reason for the setback reductions that the city had requested for the project. The Planning Commission will look at it again on August 28th, I think is
That's
what
correct.
It's scheduled for. Can you speak to any changes that may have been made to the project in the lead up to this presentation at the Planning Commission?
I don't think necessarily there's any changes to the project. What we need to do a better job of is showing what they call architectural interests that would, in a sense, defend the reasoning of asking for the variance in the setbacks. For an MPD, you are required to have 25-foot setbacks. We do meet that in certain parts of that of the development, but there are certain areas there where we've asked for a reduction down to the current zoning, which would be 10 feet. And so that's what they're going to have to take a look at. Our architects have done is kind of taken step back to show the streetscape in that area, to show how the design that we currently have right now fits better with that streetscape. Then if we were required to go to the 25-foot setbacks, what that would do to the design of the building.
So they've kind of modeled them against each other?
At a very high level modeled what possible, what the building may look like if required to go to those setbacks. And, you know, it's I would say, pretty drastic as far as the pedestrian walkway through. We'll have some larger effect on that. And then just the breakup of the design. Currently, we have those townhomes that sit right on Woodside, which is matches across the street with Woodside Phase 1, where we have the townhomes there. So there's a good transition as you continue to move up. If we are required to go to those setbacks, those townhomes would go away probably.
And it would all be like
an
larger,
apartment. That's correct.
Building.
Stack flat.
Okay.
Condos, a much larger building. Right off the beginning, rather than having that step up of the townhomes.
Right. Okay. I guess we'll find out what happens at the Planning Commission meeting. Last month, the city also held an information system on a potential affordable housing project that could go in at 100 Marsac Avenue. And there were a lot of questions from residents who attended, like how many units would go there and why would the city build on this parcel that's so steep and, you know, so near traffic? And also, can't it just remain as open space? So how is the city kind of moving ahead with all of those questions and concerns in mind?
Yeah. First off, I want to thank all the folks that did come out. It was a good turnout. It's not going to be our last opportunity by any means for a community input on this. But, you know, as far as a little background, I mean, when the city did acquire this property, the intention was for affordable housing. We've obviously been busy with some other projects, and now we're at a point where we want to start to investigate that. And that's the process we're going through right now. We've hired this architect, architectural firm, Sperano & Mooney, to go ahead and look at the property and evaluate a lot of the concerns that were raised. there wasn't any surprises with the concerns that were raised. We knew about those. You know, there's obviously soil issues. We need to get into, you know, how bad is the soil issues? How much of the soil would we have to remediate in order for a project to go in this location? I think definitely the concerns regarding traffic and walkability are real, and that's something that we need to take a look at, and that they will. They'll be doing traffic studies. It's all part of this evaluation of this property. And at the end of the day, we'll make that decision once we have all that information. Is this a viable project for us to go ahead and move forward with? We may find that, you know, it may be cost prohibitive for us, and it just doesn't make sense. Or we may find that, you know, it does make sense maybe for a couple single family homes that we could put in here. We're not sure yet. We don't, you know, people have asked, well, how many, you know, like you said, how many homes are you putting in? We don't know. We wouldn't look to, obviously, to exceed any of the zoning, you know, requirements there, and that's HR1. So it allows for single family homes or duplexes as a conditional use. But we, at this point, we're just more about gathering public input and then taking that public input and investigating some of the issues that they bring up to have that data and have that information so we can make a good decision on how we want to move forward.
Well, I know the Woodside Park development has been in the works for something like 10 years. Is this something that we're looking 10 years out to completing or moving forward with?
I hope it's not 10 years, but, you know, these projects take a lot longer than what people realize. You're right. Woodside Park, we've been working on that for over 10 years, well before I even came on for, obviously, housing. So with any of these projects, it takes a while to get through the planning process.
Let's talk about the city's land management code. And I know, you know, you're not planning Director Bruce Erickson or anything like that, but let's talk about it as it pertains to affordable housing. And this is something that Community Development Director Anne Laurent brought to the City Council at their retreat last week. With city-built projects, the planning team always works to bring the project in within the land management code. But maybe you can speak to some aspects of the LMC that make it kind of tricky to build affordable housing.
Yeah. Well, I would say that, you know, as I've gotten more familiar with development and everything like that, parking becomes a huge issue. And it's one of the major challenges that you face as a developer of whether or not you have enough parking or can fit enough parking. Also, parking, especially in this area, is expensive to build. So that really can hurt the financial model for a development. So I think what we were looking at with the land management code is, are there areas of the land management code that we could, in a sense, use as tools to help promote affordable housing? And, you know, whether that be for a city project or for a private development or a partnership. But were there some levers that we could start pulling to try to incentivize that? As I mentioned, parking is one of them. You know, is there an opportunity if certain criteria is met, whether or not it's within certain distance of a bus stop or has a car share program present, you know, or proper bike storage or electric bike charging stations, or has the bike station there, you know, that we could look at a possible reduction in the amount of parking that would be required for that development. I think we also want to look at you know, density a little bit. Is there some density bonuses that could be put forth for people that are looking to build affordable housing? So we do have Cascadia Partners out of Portland that are working with us right now. When we presented this to council, I want to say this about a year and a half ago, you know, they said these are great, but we want to see the data behind it. But if we do this, what is it? Give us some examples. So what Cascadia is really doing is they've taken some
Sorry, just to interrupt. Are they a development company?
They're a consulting firm that specializes in land management code, and they've worked with other areas in the U.S., some resort towns, some larger cities, to look at things like this and saying, how, if you were to make this change to the code, what would that mean for a possible developer?
Right.
And so it really it shows. And they'll be able to show it graphically, which is going to be really nice, what that would look, what the change could possibly look like if you were to increase density. But also they're going to look at the financial side and say, yes, this would help a developer. In this example, you know, they would save so much in development costs if you were to, say, reduce the parking requirement from, you know, one down to three quarters or whatever it may be.
Well, what about using the affordable master plan development part of the affordable housing master plan development part of the code? We don't see a lot of people doing that. And that was one, not necessarily criticism, but one point that someone made with the city's Woodside Park Phase 2 project.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's the affordable MPD is really for projects that are 100% affordable.
Will we see those?
Well, and I think that that's something that they want to look at now and say, you know, maybe there's a sliding scale, you know, maybe that they can, that would trigger the ability to use this and get some of the benefits associated with the affordable housing MPD. You know, for us with Woodside Phase 2, you know, we do have some market, or, you know, we're looking to build some market rate units, so we're not 100% affordable. But yeah, is there a sliding scale that if someone says, well, I can do 80% affordable, and then I'm going to do 20% market. Is there a way for us to help them and incentivize them to do something like that to make it pencil? You know, we'll take 80%. We don't need to have the 100% necessarily.
Jason, I guess we don't need to continue talking about policy. We have like 1 minute left. But are there any open houses or information sessions coming up around affordable housing?
You know, what we're doing right now, we're working, well, first of all, you know, for the Woodside Phase 1, we're really excited to show that off. And once we're at a point where we're through the majority of the punch list, we will be doing an open house, which is nice. This is probably the first project that we'll actually have built first before we actually go into a selection process. So it's going to be an opportunity for the public and anybody that may be interested in getting into the selection process to actually go in and look at the units and give them a better idea of which ones, you know, do they like them or not, you know, and which ones maybe would they be interested in putting their name in the hat for. So we're probably looking at the second week of September for something like that. Once we have that date, obviously we'll be pushing it out via all our media outlets and really promoting it to make sure they have a great turnout. As far as there's other things that we're looking at, excuse us, working on right now, which is more the education component. And really, you know, as part of the requirements of getting into the selection process now, what we're going to be requiring is that anybody that is looking to participate has to go through at least a 1 hour minimum orientation class that really talks about what is owning affordable housing. And then if you're a first time home buyer, we're going to be asking that you go through the first time homeowners class, which is a pretty intensive 6 hour course, but it really gets into understanding home ownership and making sure that you're prepared for it. And it may not be that you're prepared in 2 months. It may be that, hey, you should start planning right now so that in 2 years you're ready to be a homeowner.
Okay, well, be sure to let people know when that happens. Park City Housing Manager Jason Glidden, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
It's 8:52. This is the Local News Hour on KPCW. The Summit Community Garden's second Sunday event is coming up this weekend. Joining us with a preview of Sunday's event, as well as a few more coming up this month, is Summit Community Garden's Executive Director, Coley Ballou. Good morning, Coley.
Good morning, Emily.
So it looks like the gardens host a few of these second Sunday events while the weather is nice during spring and summer. What's coming up this Sunday?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, so we try to take advantage of the nice weather in our garden space and this, you know, beautiful summer days. So this second Sunday is our August second Sunday. It's our final second Sunday where we have events all day long. So starting at 8 a.m. with Yoga in the Gardens, we partner with Oak and Willow to offer yoga classes. It's a really lovely time, beautiful, serene environment, nice and peaceful. So I really encourage people to join us on our lawn space for that. And then starting at 9 o'clock, we have our coffee talks at the gardens, which is sponsored by Hugo Coffee. It's been really successful and super engaging and fun. I actually like to make a whole day of the second Sundays.
It sounds like you could plan your whole day around it.
Exactly. It has a nice balance of everything. So like I say, starting with yoga and then the coffee talks, you can enjoy a really delicious fresh cup of coffee. And then we have a speaker for that whole hour. So Luke Carton is going to be our speaker this second Sunday, the Environmental Sustainability Manager with Park City Municipal Corporation. And he's going to be talking about how sustainability at a community level is the best way to approach the climate issues we're facing, and specifically focusing on how community gardens are the key to social health for local residents, which is super awesome to be hosting this. So I really encourage people to come out and embrace this opportunity. And then starting at 10 a.m., we have our weekly volunteer work days, which have been really successful this summer also. We've been getting a lot done, and this second Sunday, we'll be working specifically on our 2019 garden expansion, including 40 additional community garden plots, which is what we're going to be doing, establishing those plots and amending the soil.
So you need people to get their hands in the dirt a bit.
Correct, yeah. And it's a kind of a nice way to get exercise, too, and just come together with other like-minded people. It's a really good time. And then there's a little break in the day, and we'll start some live music at 5 p.m. That's kind of our main feature. And this week we'll have... this weekend we'll have Basil Katz and Cruz, which is a new duo, singer-songwriters that kind of harmonize together and share songs. And while that's going on, parents can enjoy the lawn space, or parents and families can enjoy the lawn space, listening to the music with picnics in their lawn chairs, while their kids are enjoying some activities, both by Summit Community Gardens and our nonprofit partners. We have Swanner Preserve and Eco Center will be there, Summit Lands Conservancy, and National Ability Center offering family-friendly activities and kid-friendly activities. And then we'll have Mindful Cuisine with Linda Elbert, who's one of our plot renters. And she'll be doing a cooking demo at a little
with
intermission
fresh produce.
Break. Exactly. All produce from the garden. So that'll be really fun and inspiring. So it should be a great time, open to all the community, and we encourage people to come out and enjoy.
Well, August is a busy month for you. You also have two adult education classes coming up. Tell us about those real quick.
We do, yeah. So August is kind of harvest time in Park City, so we have an abundance of both flowers and vegetables. So our harvest and designing flower bouquets class is on Tuesday, August 13th from 6 to 7:30 p.m. So that's kind of nice because it's a little bit cooler in the day. We'll go over how to efficiently and successfully harvest flowers, and then we'll do a hands-on workshop. We'll do a demonstration of how to arrange a flower bouquet, and then each of the students will be able to take home said bouquet to their family and friends.
You don't just cut the flowers at the stems?
That's
right.
That's not how it works. Yeah, exactly. A little more to it, but should be a great time. And then on Thursday, the same week, August 15th from 6 to 7:30 p.m. at the gardens as well, we'll be going over some ways to first observe when to harvest some things that people might not always know. So like potatoes, carrots, and garlic is what we're focusing on. Signs of when to harvest them, and then how to most successfully harvest them, because it can be a little bit tricky. And then garlic specifically, we'll go over the best way to cure that and store it. In September, we'll be going over storing root vegetables specifically too, so that will be a good time. And the best way to stay up to date on that is not only on our website, summitcommunitygardens.org, but also social media, because sometimes things can change, and so staying up to date on class offerings, etc.
You're on Facebook then?
Oh, yeah, sorry. Social media, Facebook and Instagram, yes.
You also have a dinner coming up. Tell us about that.
We do. We're super excited. This is our fourth annual dig-in dinner, partnering with Eats, that we offer in the garden space. Again, just really embracing and taking advantage of such a beautiful space and in the abundance of the growing season. So this is our, fourth annual. We'll open the gardens to 400 parents, children, and fellow community members to share in a family dinner in the gardens. And this, of course, is in honor of Family Meal Awareness Month. The meal serves as a celebration of local food and a beautiful space, as well as the community at large. So tickets are going fast. It always sells out before the event. So there's still tickets available at eatsparkcity.org/dig-in. So I encourage people to go and get their ticket today.
Any idea what's on the menu?
Well, we actually are partnering with several vendors in town, and we try to use produce again from the gardens, but we'll have everything from, we're trying to focus on a heavier vegetable offerings this season, and a little bit less on the meat side. So
it's better for you.
Right? It'll be great. It'll be really awesome. Yeah. So definitely encourage people to come on out.
Okay. Coley, was there anything else you wanted to mention?
One more thing. We're just really privileged to be featured as one of the new nonprofits on the KPCW Summer Pledge Drive. So our spotlight will be on Wednesday, the 21st of August at 10 a.m. So listen in.
Thank you so much for joining us then and now. That's Coley Ballou from Summit Community Gardens.